Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, welcome to the Kindling's Muse at the Movies, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in today's culture. And over the next 30 minutes, we're going to discuss some current releases, a few DVD releases, and some classics every thoughtful film goer could see, along with a pick of the summer from our guests, Jeffrey Overstreet, film critic, author of Aurelia's Color, Through a Screen Darkly, and just released Cinderi's Midnight. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Cinder, but thank you.
He clarified before I said it, and I still got it wrong. Jeffrey continuing his quest towards titles that no one in broadcasting could get right the first time, and doing so successfully. Also joining us is Greg Wright. He's the managing editor of HollywoodJesus.com and Past the Popcorn. And wow, we've missed the whole summer. You guys have a good movie-going summer, or were other things on the docket primarily?
Oh, it was so-so.
It was so-so. It started off good and kind of petered out in the middle and some nice things at the end.
Yeah. As is usually the case, we'll start finding out that there were all kinds of amazing films released this summer around the world. But, of course, we won't see them until 2011 when they finally arrive here on DVD. So,
well, let's get going with your picks of the summer. And what a great, enthusiastic way to start a show with both panelists saying, I had a so-so summer, and I'm really glad to be here, Dick. let's start with WALL-E, which, Jeff, you were going to kick us off on WALL-E.
Well, there were some highlights this summer, and for me, WALL-E was one of them. It's so rare an occasion that we find a film that kids can enjoy and their parents can enjoy, that has strong storytelling, groundbreaking special effects, in this case, groundbreaking digital animation. And WALL-E is as the reviewer for Variety called it, the ninth consecutive wonder from Pixar. And I'm inclined to agree with him. Andrew Stanton, who wrote Finding Nemo, also wrote and directed WALL-E. And he has come up with Pixar's first science fiction film that really is, I think, a serious work of science fiction, even though six-year-olds will enjoy it. It gives grown-ups a lot to think about, too. It's a story of a robot who's been designed to clean up a polluted Earth. And he happens to find something that means there might be hope for Earth to come back to life, so to speak. Humanity has given up on Earth, has shipped out in something that looks like the Ark. That'd be Noah's Ark, not the Ark of the Covenant, in order to get away from this place that we've trashed. And WALL-E the robot finds a glimmer of hope that maybe the world can be saved and ends up cleaning up a lot more than polluted Earth. He starts cleaning up humanity's understanding of what Earth is for and what humanity is capable of. And perhaps more than any other Pixar movie, now it'd probably be better to say this is the first Pixar movie that's really controversial. The film took a lot of flack for what some people thought was a mockery of the obese. When WALL-E finally catches up with humanity in the future, almost the entire human race have turned into giant slobs, basically. But the movie explains that by suggesting when you're outside the pull of gravity, human bodies tend to lose their shape, and there's some real science there. But it was also a commentary on consumerism, and or really on reckless consumerism.
Yeah, but here's what's weird. I just read a report that by the year 2030, 100% of Americans will be obese.
Well,
if we continue on our current trend with younger kids. So, I mean, it's another prophetic film from Pixar.
Very, very
Greg,
likely.
What would you add about this film?
Well, I thought it was actually two different films in one, and the first one I thought was actually a splendid science fiction picture. But then once they leave the planet, I thought it just kind of launched into silly satire, because you lost the science. The bone density thing is real. You spend time in space, you lose bone density. It doesn't mean you get fat.
Yeah.
Losing bone density doesn't mean, you know, because women with osteoporosis would all be obese if you lost bone density.
Yeah.
But the two don't equate. So it's a leap, you know, it's a logical leap that's quasi-scientific but not really science fiction.
The movie has the longest opening silent sequence in animation history other than a silent film. I mean, how many minutes did we go in this film before we actually heard Waller.
Well, I'd say There Will Be Blood would give it a run for its money. That was there was
but that wasn't so animated.
15
though.
To 20. Yeah, that's true.
Not exactly an animated film.
That's true.
Wow.
15 to 20 silent minutes at the beginning there, and I don't know that I'd argue that these are silent minutes. Just basically, the robots don't speak English, but they are, you know,
brilliant audio.
Beeping a lot.
Yeah, the audio design is brilliant.
Yeah, Ben Burtt, the guy who did the sound design for Wall-E, called it R2-D2 the movie because Burtt designed all the sounds of R2-D2, and he just basically has a field day with this movie, coming up with all these amazing sound effects. And it's amazing how eloquent the robots are, considering that they don't talk. So
now Stanton has done a number of interesting interviews about how his faith informs his work, because he is a person who is a follower of Jesus, but he also believes that work needs to kind of stand on its own. The work needs to be craftsmanlike. Is there kind of a theological pattern emerging from his film? Like, if you look at Nemo and you look at this one, are we learning something about the issues that matter to him?
Oh, clearly. I think Pixar has made, all of the Pixar storytellers have shown a real concern for family, for healthy family lives. In Wall-E, there's clearly a concern for how we are stewards or are failing at stewardship in the natural world. But there's also a Noah's Ark story, as I mentioned before, going on here. And Eve, the robot Eve, is very much the dove who comes to Earth looking for the olive branch.
Yeah.
And so there are influences there. But I don't think the film is too preachy for a children's story. It's like a Jonathan Swift satire.
Stanton's work is more organic than didactic. So those elements creep in, but so do all kinds of other elements that influence him. So I think, for instance, that Wall-E functions as well as an allegory about the Pixar and Disney subculture and the tension between those two halves of that business as it does as anything else. And that's just a natural byproduct of the fact that that's where those guys are from and that's the context in which they're working.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But he's not, Stanton doesn't set out to say, I'm going to make a movie version of the story of Noah's Ark. I mean, that's not how it works.
Exactly. Dark Knight, Greg, is on your top pick of the summer. What do you want to tell us about Dark Knight?
Well, it's because it's the elephant in the room. I mean, you can't get away from it. There is no question that The Dark Knight was the movie event of the summer from the time it opened all the way through pretty much the end of the summer, not only here in the United States but around the world. Does that make it a great film? Well, I don't think so, but, you know, that's not the point, especially not what I think. I walked out of the movie and I thought, holy cow, what happened to summer movies being fun? Like Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End last year. I mean, those movies are tough slogs. They're not just kickback popcorn munching movies. You pretty much have to pay attention, particularly in The Dark Knight. I actually, after having thought about it and after having read some feedback to my review at Pass the Popcorn, decided that I was a little hard on the film to start with, because there was a lot in that film that I thought was actually very, very sloppy filmmaking. And after seeing how audiences are responding to it and after reading some other reviews, I realized that's actually the design of the movie. Christopher Nolan deliberately doesn't wrap things up scene by scene. He comes to the end of a scene. He may give you all the information that you feel like you want to know what happens at the end of the scene. He may not, but frankly, he doesn't care. It's almost like he's Cameron, you know, figuring out exactly what audiences want, serving it up, delivering it right straight to them, getting on to the next thing. You know, it's all about what's next, what happens next. It's not necessarily about filling in all the blanks and the details. And while at one level you can call that sloppy filmmaking, on the other you can call it incredibly canny and intelligent. And I think that's the way audiences are responding to it. So it was very dark, very entertaining, but sharp and intelligent.
That's kind of interesting. Because
but also kind of degenerated toward the end into an action fest.
If you look at comics and the space between frames, the reader is allowed to fill in space between frames.
That's right.
And that's kind of what happens in a film like this, mm-hmm. where you've got abruptness that ends up with you having a momentary kind of space to imagine.
Yep.
What were your reflections on Dark Knight?
I thought it was one of the most awe-inspiring comic book movies I've ever seen, partly because it was so ambitious and so complex. And this may be the first comic book movie I've seen that really asks you to question the ethics and character of the superhero, Batman himself. It's kind of interesting that the villains and Batman's cronies, so to speak, become so prominent in the film, play such important parts that Batman almost becomes a supporting character. I just didn't find Batman too terribly interesting as a character. Lucius, for example, the gadget guy played by Morgan Freeman, or Alfred played by Michael Caine, both raise fascinating questions about Batman's tactics and challenge him.
Yeah.
And we don't really get into Batman's head to understand what he's thinking or why he's making certain decisions. He ends up making decisions that are very questionable. And some people said, you know, the film was a defense of W's invasion of Iraq. And I find that incredibly simplistic. But there were some interesting parallels to questions about force.
Yes, and that's the way you get inside Bruce Wayne's head, is by parallels of what actually is going on in our world. So there are connection points there for the audience, even though it's not spelled out and laid out in the script. So in a way, you can, if you choose to, get inside President Bush's head. Mm-hmm. But is it a deliberate commentary on that? No, it doesn't go that far.
Did either of you have any comments you wanted to make about Heath Ledger? I mean, that was the other elephant in the room in this film.
Yeah, well, it's amazing we got this far without mentioning him. His performance is, I think, the highlight of the film. It was not overhyped, I don't think, in any way. He really, really amazed me with his choices. He was always unpredictable, always went somewhere I didn't expect, and also just very, very funny at times.
Yeah.
I think they made him a little too clever as a character. There are times when, after the movie, as I walked away and got over sort of the dazzle of it, I started thinking, now, wait a minute, how could the Joker have possibly anticipated these things? But that's standard for comic book movies. And frankly, I'm glad to say that most of these reviewers were wrong. This was not Ledger's final performance. He is the star of the next Terry Gilliam movie. That will be out in several months, and we'll get to see something he did after The Dark Knight. And several other actors stepped in to finish up the performance that he gave in that film, to play that character and finish it out, as a tribute to him, basically. Wow. So that we can see the last work that he did.
Real quickly, both of you had on your pick of the summer list The Visitor, which we've already talked about briefly before, but it's noteworthy because now we're at the end of the summer and we realize, wow, the American film-going audience actually bought into a more thoughtful film this summer.
Yes, it wasn't exactly the runaway success of something like A Room with a View, where this independent film comes out and hits one out of the park, or Four Weddings and a Funeral. But The Visitor did hold on in the markets it was playing in for about 4 to 5 months over a summer that was packed with big, huge, super mondo budget blockbusters. And that in itself is an incredible, incredible feat. And it wasn't, you know, some costume period piece or some big flamboyant thing. It was a quiet drama about real people in real situations, in situations that really do affect us in the here and now, in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the director, Tom McCarthy, directed one of my favorite movies, The Station Agent. I think if there's a DVD in my collection I loan out the most, it's The Station Agent. He likes stories about lonely, lost men who have sort of...
Doesn't that really fit us all?
who's wandered away from the real calling of his life, the meaning of his life, and when he comes back to his long closed New York apartment and finds two illegal immigrants living there, we think we're going into a very political movie, and there are definitely political points being made along the way, but really this is a story about learning what matters in life all over again, learning about relationships, learning to take risks, learning to be vulnerable enough to fall in love.
Yeah.
And one of the most wonderful things about the film, besides Richard Jenkins' incredible performance, is how completely unresolved the standard storylines are at the
end.
Yes, exactly. Everything is left hanging except the real story. And mm-hmm. if people are really thinking about why did the movie end there, of all places, mm-hmm. they're going to discover what the real story was. Mm. And I love McCarthy's courage in seeing that to the end.
Mm. Well, in theaters right now, Jeff, you wanted to start with Burn After Reading.
I wanted to start with it because over the summer, it was one of the most anticipated movies for film critics and for me as a big Coen Brothers fan. The Coen Brothers always serve up something worth talking about. Now, where it falls in the various subcategories of the Coen collection, that's a matter of some debate. Is it a wacky, comedy with a simple moral lesson like O Brother, Where Art Thou? No, not really. Is it a dark thriller like No Country for Old Men? No, not really. It really harkens back to Raising Arizona, the movie that really woke the world up to the Coen brothers, in that all of these characters are exaggerations. All of them are big political cartoons. They're all just Looney Tunes, really. And yet they are Looney Tunes of a very subversive and twisted variety. And I think that's what makes Burn After Reading hard to watch at points, is that these characters who all get caught up in a scandal around so-called high-level intelligence when a CIA man loses an important disc, what we see happen is they just start acting monstrously toward one another, trying to get whatever they value. I mean, Francis McDormand's character is after plastic surgery. Brad Pitt's character is just after the thrill of being caught up in something scandalous and exciting, and you know, like the movies. George Clooney's character is just after the next person he's going to sleep with, it seems like. And these people are just so disgusting toward one another that there are a lot of those laughs along the way where you don't feel too good about laughing. And they go farther than they ever have with the crass humor. And I feel like they're getting a little lazy with their comedies, that they're going for the easy laugh through profanity, the easy laugh through the gross joke. And I really miss the brilliant wordplay of Raising Arizona and Barton Fink.
But, you know, this is what happens when you start having deadlines and demands to crank stuff out. I mean, you know that. You're a writer. It's hard to stay at the top of your game.
Well, and that's why, for me, I think the movie functions best as another one of the Coens' internal commentaries on their own craft, their own process of movie making, and how that fits into the business. Just as they were blocked when they were working on Miller's Crossing and cranked out Barton Fink to talk about the process of working through writer's block.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a commentary on the process of them working through the problem of adapting No Country for Old Men and greeting resistance within the studio and from critics and audiences alike about the choices that they made there.
Yeah. Wow.
So I feel it's an incredibly personal statement by the Coens. And frankly, they don't really care how much anybody else enjoys it, which is their prerogative.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see that their next film is starring a bunch of actors who are not big name celebrities, because I think that'll be a chance for us to discover Coen characters again.
Yeah.
One of the things I think that hurts this movie is that it is George Clooney and Brad Pitt.
George Clooney and Tilda Swinton.
Yeah,
matching up that pairing from Michael Clayton. I mean, this is all internal commentary about casting.
Ping pong player.
Absolutely delightful film to come in at the end of the summer. This is a small independent film made by Chinese Americans. They actually talk about it being a Chinese American film because it's made by Chinese Americans, about Chinese Americans, with Chinese American funding and for the Chinese American market. But I tell you, it's fun. I mean, if you want to get some insight into another segment of our society and see how they think and how they think about themselves in the context of larger culture, it's fantastic. The basic story is that there's this absolutely wacky young guy, total typical American slacker. He happens to be Chinese American, who can't hold down jobs like selling cell phones in malls, but thinks he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and in particular thinks he aspires to play in the NBA and be like Yao Ming. The problem is he's about 5'6", so he plays basketball with little kids and stuff. And his family is basically invested in the whole ping pong culture, and his championship ping pong playing brother, who also is a doctor, of course, the typical successful Asian man, injures himself, and his mom gets injured, so he has to take over not only the family business, but win the ping pong tournament in order to save his family's reputation and their businesses. And it's just sharp, sharp, sharp fun humor. Instead of the ladled on, crass, overdone, gross out humor that we've been getting all summer long.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a small film. There is some language creatively bleeped out. They actually censor their own swear words with the use of sound effects, which I've never seen before. So another kudo for them for that. But just out and out, fun-spirited, new and original. Jimmy Tsai, as the central character, C-Dub Wang, is one of the most original characters you will ever see on film.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona, quick comment from each of you.
Well,
hard to make quick comments on Woody Allen.
It really, really is. I mean, Woody Allen's films are usually about people making big mistakes in their love lives and walking away feeling a little bewildered about what really happened there. This is no exception. I felt like with this one, it just felt a little bit lazy in the storytelling. It was leisurely to get to hang out in Barcelona and beautifully filmed with beautiful actresses.
But does he have anything new to say?
I didn't pick up anything new that he's saying here. It just seems like his characters are taking wild, reckless risks yet again in love, to speak. It looks more like lust to me. And then just staggering away, shell-shocked, like, well, why did that happen? And I get really tired of that.
Yeah, I get kind of tired of that, too. And in reflection, I thought, well, maybe there's a little modulation here. There's a scene very early on in the film when Vicky and Christina first arrive in Barcelona, and they're driving through the streets at night, which is a scene that's very reminiscent from Whit Stillman's Barcelona from about a decade ago, except as they're driving by one of the gaudy pieces of architecture in the town, there are a bunch of people waving around sparklers on the sidewalk, and there are sparks falling down all around them. And I thought, wow, kind of like some things that Woody Allen has done in some of his recent films. That seems like an instant visual metaphor for, it's fun to play with fire, but it's raining down all around you, too, and you might just get burned. And as it turns out, that really does happen with these characters in this film. And at the end, the voiceover adds at least a little bit of ironic overlay to suggest that maybe all of that hedonistic fun wasn't so much fun. So I think there's at least some modulation to it.
He has got himself in a philosophical bind because he's concluded that life has absolutely no meaning.
Yeah.
He's continuing to make films and making the same point, and after a while you say, okay, it has no meaning, so there's going to be no consistent kind of moral compass, and he's kind of It's after a while you've gotten that message, and what more do I want to hear?
He used to engage questions about religion very directly and questions about faith very directly, and now it's reduced to just a forgettable moment in this movie where Javier Bardem is staring up at a crucifix, and he tells the girls he's seducing that this is his favorite work of art, and they ask him why, does it mean something to you, and he goes, oh no, and they walk away, and that's it.
Exactly.
It's almost like he's almost laughing at the people
who are
looking for
it. But I think that's his conclusion. I think he's at an age in life where he's seeing the end game of his own philosophy of life, and there's nothing there. And so he stopped asking serious questions about it.
It is fun to make movies in London and Barcelona, though, and as long as he's out there in Europe
and
taking his tour.
And somebody will pay him to do it.
Well, and you've got Scarlett Johansson along to, kind of have fun with.
You go.
Yeah, is life so meaningless after all?
He actually said in a recent interview that all of his movies are nothing but diversions.
Yeah.
That there is nothing actually, he's not really trying to say anything. So if you're going to have a diversion, make it a pretty scene with some interesting people.
All I can say is if people go see it, watch for the scene in which Scarlett Johansson rides a bike and ask yourself, has she ever ridden a bike before?
And on that important philosophical note, departing from Woody Allen's recent superficiality, we go to DVDs that are out there right now. And one that Jeff picked, and I'm so impressed with this pick because I saw this film at Sundance a year ago and was so affected by it. And it was one of those films where we were taking a bunch of students, and it showed at midnight. And it's 3 hours long, subtitled. It's slowly, at least 2.5. It's a slowly unfolding subtitled film. But it was brilliant. And you chose it. Tell us why.
Well, I chose it because you very rarely see religion explored in a film so seriously. I mean, this is set in a Russian Orthodox monastery, where a monk is causing a lot of trouble by being something of a prankster. And the film opens with some insight into why this particular monk is so messed up, so to speak. Or is he so messed up? Is he perhaps coping with the burden of guilt for what he did when he was a young man by devoting himself so fully to God that he is going to teach the other monks a thing or two about humility, a thing or two about reverence in the presence of God. And as he monkeys with the expectations of the monks, but didn't mean to say that exactly, it's great to watch them because they are pious, honorable men who, for the sake of control, want to sort of put a leash on this guy. But they begin to wrestle with some very serious questions. And the film also raises questions about miracles. And frankly, I'm just glad it's finally here, because I think over time, moviegoers, especially Christian moviegoers, are going to discover it and really appreciate the way it deals with issues like even abortion without a sledgehammer, just letting characters encounter these dilemmas on their own and wrestle with them the way human beings do in their everyday lives.
Well, Russian literature has got the holy fool kind of metaphor throughout it, and here you have one where you actually come to some insight as to why this person ended up who they are, and some actual resolution of their issues and questions. It's just a brilliantly done film, and I remember before we went to the film, Craig Detweiler was kind of leading a discussion on it. He said, you've got to invest yourself in this. You've got to watch it. You've got to give it time. Mm-hmm. You've got to let it kind of unfold. And that was good advice, because if you invest in a film like this, it's just well worth it.
Well, I didn't find it boring in any way because it was so beautifully filmed.
Yeah.
I mean, even in this bleak landscape, I was just fascinated by this place. It looked like another planet.
Well, of course, I live on an island, and islands are still fascinating to me now that I've moved there. Greg, Red Belt.
Well, David Mamet is, of course, one of our great American treasures, and if you're from the Midwest, one of our great Chicago treasures. A playwright and screenwriter and filmmaker whose vision has always been about hard cases, cynics, and burnouts in the making, and his stories about how principles get compromised and how idealists and crusaders become, sadly, realists. And so when I went to see Red Belt, which he both wrote and directed, I was expected for more of the traditional David Mamet treatment. The story is about
jiu-jitsu.
You're going to have to edit that out on me, Alfred. Jiu-jitsu.
No, we're going to actually loop it and repeat it 20
times. Oh, that would be great. Yeah, so. Can you do
it'll
a ring?
Be a standalone
do
piece.
A ringtone for me. A jiu-jitsu instructor.
Very good.
Played by Chiwetel Ejiofor. So there's a whole bunch of tongue twisters involved in this movie. Who gets placed in a situation where his principles and ethics are tested. It's a very, very simple story about how the Brazilian jiu-jitsu community works in the Los Angeles area, and how everything is about business and money. And yet Mike Terry is a man of principle and has very simple goals and wants to protect them, and gets tested by the temptation of debt, in which he has to actually satisfy and pay off a debt. And so he is tempted to compromise his principles. The interesting thing about this film is that it is perhaps the most personal of Mamet's films, in which he actually says, and this is his statement, that the film is about a vision of correct moral behavior in all circumstances, and that he personally believes the philosophy of jiu-jitsu provides a means of determining what that correct moral behavior is in all circumstances. Mm-hmm. And when you come to the ending of the movie, this is not your traditional David Mamet film, where the ending is achieved by somebody learning that their idealism is wrong. Mm-hmm. It's about a man who learns that his idealism is right and pays the price of sticking to it.
But Mamet has been talking about this in his interviews and personal life about his own journey. And this is another example of a film. If you listen to a film that from someone like Mamet, whose imprint is on a film. You know, most films are so collaborative, you don't actually hear the voice. But he's got that kind of control. You really can see what his journey is beginning to look like.
Yeah, you really can. And I think that's why it's important for anybody who's ever seen Mamet films to see this one and then put this into context. It will allow you to reevaluate every Mamet film and script that you've ever been exposed to.
We were in New York and went to one of the Mamet off-Broadway plays, and it was just totally depressing. And there was an intermission, and I'll never forget these two old ladies in front of these New Yorkers. One of them leans over to the other and says, "What do you think?" And she said, "Oh, it's so Mamet." And it was just this total depressing moment. I thought, wow, we got a whole other half to look forward to. Well, let's look real quickly at our classic picks. These are movies that our reviewers think everybody ought to have seen. And Jeff, you've already kind of tipped your hat at a film that you think everybody ought to see, Raising Arizona.
Well, yes, if you haven't seen it already, and I wouldn't say this is a film for kids or maybe even teenagers, but it is a hilarious farce that the Coen brothers released. It was their second film. They made a great comedy called Blood Simple that sort of put them on the film festival map, and the independent filmmaker map. But Raising Arizona broke through, and I think to this day it's still the funniest, if not the best thing that Nicolas Cage ever did. It's, I think, also the funniest and best thing Holly Hunter ever did. And putting those two together was just brilliant chemistry.
And John Goodman is...
John Goodman...
Wasn't this one of his first...
One of his first movies proved that he is a formidable comic actor way outside the bounds of what he was doing on Roseanne on television.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he came in to Barton Fink after that and delivered a terrifying
performance. I'll show you the life of the mind.
That's right. That's right. But in Raising Arizona, it's got to be one of the most quotable movies ever made. The rapid-fire comedy throughout... You could just read the script and double over with laughter. It's basically about a crook who gets out of jail and marries a policewoman. The Coens have always had a soft spot for criminals and hoping that they might be redeemable in some way. And these two get married and want to pursue the American dream, and they discover that she is infertile. And right about the same time in the news, you find out that a furniture wholesaler, Nathan Arizona, he and his wife have just had quintuplets. And so according to these two, who have none, they say, you know, well, they got more than they can handle. And so they go after one of these babies, figuring the parents, you know, they won't mind losing one. So they steal a baby, and pretty soon the baby becomes the MacGuffin, so to speak, the thing that everybody's after. And what it becomes is a brilliant story about rationalizations, about the little lies we're willing to tell ourselves in order to get what we want, and about the American dream and what it's really made of and how really conservative, in a sense, the American dream really is about, you know, raising a family and having your own home. And I do think that the Coens are, for all of their liberal humor, very interested in family values at the end of the day. Fargo definitely showed that. Fargo had a very affectionate portrayal of the hope of a family at the end of this story that involved criminals and a wood chipper. But I think Raising Arizona is still their funniest movie, and their, for all of the obvious humor, there are these wonderful little subtle things you may not notice until the 10th time you've seen it. I just realized recently that the real villain of the pick, this destructive monster called the Lone Biker of the Apocalypse, his name is Leonard Smalls. Well, Lenny Smalls is the idiot who kills small animals in Of Mice and Men. And here's the Lone Biker of the Apocalypse riding around with a shotgun.
They're full of stuff like
blasting
this.
At bunny rabbits. Yeah. So, it's a masterpiece. And I think anybody who wants to write smart comedy should memorize Raising Arizona.
Wow. There's a challenging assignment. Well, Greg, you're going to finish us up today with The Untouchables.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to learn how to write smart drama with quotable dialogue, you should turn to David Mamet and The Untouchables, directed by David De Palma, but written by David Mamet. And it's obviously a story about Elliot Ness and Al Capone, based not on either reality or the TV series, but on David Mamet's own idea about the struggle between good and evil, and reflects kind of what I was saying earlier about his vision of how crusaders become realists, because Elliot Ness must learn to compromise his principles in order to bring down Elliot Ness. At one point, he tells the judge, "I have become what I beheld and am content that I have done right."
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think it's a really interesting companion piece to The Dark Knight, to see those two films back to back, side by side, and see that they're, you know, even though they were filmed 20 years apart, Untouchables in 1987, continuity, like you wouldn't believe, in terms of cultural attitudes and the way that we respond to entertainment when it talks about how evil is approached and how evil must be dealt with. And also, I think one of the most brilliant films ever made in terms of achieving both wild success as entertainment and also as art.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very balanced picture with some brilliant performances from a young Kevin Costner, a younger but still older Sean Connery, Andy Garcia. Supporting cast is brilliant. Just about everything about it is brilliant. Very, very enjoyable. And the quotable dialogue just never ends out of that one either.
Hmm.
It also has one of the great continuity blunders ever in movies. So there's a scene where Sean Connery is sitting across the table from somebody, and every time the camera goes back to him, the top button of his shirt collar is either open or closed. And it's almost like it was a
so
deliberate,
let me guess,
humor.
You have fast forwarded to watch back and forth. Well, anyway, folks, it's been another really interesting conversation with our guests, Jeffrey Overstreet and Greg Wright. Jeffrey, of course, is the author of the book that just came out today, this being September the 15th. It comes out tomorrow.
It comes out tomorrow,
Cinder's Midnight, not to be confused with Cinderi's Midnight. Well, and by the way, it's spelled C-Y-N-D-E-R-E-S. Yeah. So when you're going to Amazon and looking it up, don't try to spell Cinders in any normal way, because after all, you're dealing with a work by Jeffrey Overstreet here. So you're going to have to go in a different direction.
I'm trying to avoid a bestseller, so I make it as hard to find as possible.
Well, you could have done better if you would have started with a Z, so it would show up last in every alphabetical listing. But our guests are Jeffrey Overstreet, Greg Wright. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for joining us on the Kindlings Muse. If you're listening on iTunes, please feel free to go and comment at thekindlings.com, where we always allow you to get in on the conversation and post your comments as well. By the way, if you're wondering where Jenny is, our lovely Jenny Spohr, who's a usual participant, she is home with her lovely newborn child, and we wish her the best, and she'll be back with us in a few months after her maternity leave. And fortunately, we've got two guys that can't use a maternity leave as a reason for not being here, so hopefully
congratulations to you, Jeff.
Again, it's next month. This is Dick Staub. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on the Kindlings Muse at the Movie.